Hello and welcome to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting filmmaker Gary Hustwit to learn about his film focusing on the life of influential designer Dieter Rams.
And things will be taking a surprising turn with philosopher Maria Balaska, whose work deals with the concept of astonishment. She'll be joining us later on the show.
And we'll be checking in with musician Felix White, the former Maccabees guitarist and now sports writer, broadcaster and soundtrack composer, about how he became involved in the new cricket documentary, The Edge.
That's all coming up, plus Monaco's Peter Firth will be looking ahead to next week's news and we'll enjoy some tunes too, right here on the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24. Always lovely to see you, Og. And I think our main story of the week was that we watched Midsommar, right? It's our type of film.
Finally. We both finally got to see Midsommar. What did you think?
I quite enjoyed it, but the problem of a film like this, there's so much hype around it. I mean, here in the office, everybody was talking about it. So I was a little bit disappointed. But then at the same time, I mean, the director is impressive. I mean, it's such a beautiful film to watch, even though it's quite gory.
It is beautiful. I've read a lot of reviews crediting the art director, whose name, obviously, I've forgotten now. But yeah, you're right. I wondered about the overhypeness. I thought about his last film, Hereditary, as well. And I was talking to a friend and saying that I wonder if it's a reaction to the paucity of genuinely good cinema, that when a film that's actually not that good, but quite good, looks good, deals with interesting themes, has some good actors in it, when it comes out, people latch onto it and talk about it as though it's Rosemary's Baby. Well, that is the latest from Midori House. Should we have a look at next week's news now, Faye?
We'd love to.
Who is it? None other than Peter Firth.
Welcome, Peter, to the show. I mean, I'm very excited because last week's news about the nudism in the UK was quite interesting.
Did you go?
I didn't, unfortunately.
Peter, but did you go?
No, I couldn't quite make it work with my diary, unfortunately.
A missed opportunity.
It is a missed opportunity, and I don't think I'd have been comfortable there. I'm actually...
Very repressed.
Exactly. I'm very highly repressed and a bit of a prude, really. So,
well, why don't you tell us what's going on this week?
All right, so I will. So, happily, those bored by the relative inactivity of the weekend will be quite relieved to hear that there are some hefty geopolitical events due to kick off this week. So I've got three stories that we're going to be following as of Monday. So tomorrow, the European Parliament is expected to vote on the nomination of Ursula von der Leyen as the new president of the European Commission.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Now, von der Leyen is currently Germany's defence minister, and by all accounts, it's a great step up for her, as the current post is kind of something of a bit of a graveyard shift, given Germany's policy of resting on its hands when it comes to its military. We've been told on the news desk by a number of analysts that it's kind of the right time for von der Leyen. She's got strong links with NATO, has the force of character and profile to be taken seriously in Washington, and she's extremely ambitious, which is, by the way, why she's never really reached the upper echelons of the government in Germany.
They saw her coming, did they? They punctured her bubble.
They did indeed, and shipped her off to the European Union. She'll need 376 votes in Parliament, or an absolute majority of MEPs. She'll have a chance to address those MEPs in the morning, and voting will begin at midday. Now, hopefully, given that she has the support of the council, this all should go off without a hitch.
Jolly good. What's next?
So, on Wednesday and Thursday this week, the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister and the US Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security are going to meet in Geneva for a bit of a powwow there. The top line is that it's a discussion on global strategic stability. And now what that really means is that this is about the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty, drawn up between Reagan and Gorbachev in 1987. Obviously, the treaty decrees that neither power can develop missiles capable of hitting targets between 500 to 5,500 kilometres. But Putin, in his kind of inimitable way, started to bend and then break those rules with the Russian nine, kind of quite a sexy name for this missile. It's called the 9M729 missile. So the thing is, these two met back in January already, and the talks were just an absolute failure.
Really?
They both came out saying disappointing.
Omni-shambles.
It was an omni-shambles. And so looking ahead to this one this week, it's kind of interesting to look at what's actually changed, because I think the answer is not very much.
Right. And can we relate that to their personal relation? Do they just not click as negotiators, do you think? Or is it, was it an omni-shambles as a consequence of like their higher-ups' pressure? Because the relationship between Trump and Putin remains one of the great kind of strange, anomalous things, doesn't it? His attitude towards Russia is sort of at times hard line. We see in Turkey where he's refusing to train even their pilots for the F-2 bomber jets that he's selling them, because they're going to buy these S-400 missiles from Russia. So on the one hand, he's kind of sanctioning in Haiti, but then at the same time, he clearly admires Putin. He clearly wants to be friends. Is it all fluster? Is it performative, his sort of attitude towards the Russian?
I think when it comes to Trump and the US, of course, I think there is a great degree of showmanship with it, and kind of having these huge, what are effectively media events, you know, look at what... At his presence in North Korea a few weeks ago, where effectively there's very little in the way of geopolitical progress happening there in terms of, you know, looking at denuclearizing the North or even returning to the negotiating table with the INF treaty. But then, of course, it enables Trump, obviously eyeing the 2020 elections, to sell it as a great win back home.
Peter, we've had quite a heavy starter and main course. Have we got a nice light pudding?
I'm counting on you, Peter, for that.
Or more stodge.
No, we've got something much light, delectable, in fact. So, bad news this week for sexually frustrated teenagers in Britain.
What happened?
So a new age check scheme is coming into play this week to prevent the under-18s from looking at pornographic websites.
Oh, dear.
Such a killjoy, isn't it?
The frustration in teenage bedrooms around the UK is going to be...
Is it really going ahead? I mean, isn't it just quite sensorial?
Well, this is the thing, Faye. So, affected sites will have to verify the age of UK visitors. It's not clear how that's going to happen just yet. But the ones that fail to comply will be blocked by internet service providers. But critics are basically saying that teens, sort of technologically conversant as they are just going to be able to find a reach around. Workaround.
Oh, dear me.
And basically bypass the restriction some way, which will involve them going on the dark web or visiting illegal platforms, which are even more difficult to regulate. So it makes you question the wisdom of the whole exercise. And it's almost a case of, again, policy lagging behind behaviours around technology.
It's a shocking news, actually.
I'm not sure if I'd call that delectable, but it was certainly a nice little ender. Thank you, Peter. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, and in a moment we'll be hearing from Gary Hustwit about his new film that looks at how Dieter Rams changed design.
California-born, New York-based filmmaker Gary Hustwit has been creating documentaries about design for over a decade. That began with his 2007 film Helvetica, which looked at typography. And his most recent film, Runs, focuses on the less is more ethos of influential German product designer Dieter Rams.
Rams' 10 principles of good design for brands such as Braun and Vitsu mean his sleek, functional objects are now housed in New York's Museum of Modern Art. And anyone who thinks products such as Apple's iPod appeared out of nowhere might want to check out Ram's Braun T3 transistor radio, created nearly half a century earlier.
Monocle Stonehall spoke to Gary Hustwit about the film and more. They began by discussing what makes Dieter Rams' story unique.
You know, in product design circles, he's, you know, looked at as a kind of pioneer, as... You know, he's known for this very kind of minimal design, you know, less but better is his motto. And, you know, he's influenced so many other designers, most notably Jony Ive, ex-Apple designer. A lot of the things you look at Apple, and I think so many even digital interfaces, I think, are influenced by this idea of stripping things down, making them clear, making them simple.
I mean... That was one thing as I watched the documentary. I didn't know too much about Dieter Rams, but I also didn't actually know too much about the story of Braun or brown, as they say in German. That really surprised me because the brand to me is, you know, synonymous with your first shaver or something, but these very sort of householdy, quite kind of not too exciting today products. But I had no awareness that in the sort of 1950s, 60s, 70s, it was this almost really sort of aggressively forward thinking, utopian almost design mindset, producing really, really unique, unusual products. Tell us a little bit about Dieter's journey with them.
Well, he trained as an architect early on, but once he left school, kind of got swept up into Braun as a first to do some interior design work for their offices. But then I think they realized his talent and got him into product design. And, you know, this is a time in post-World War II Germany when you've got this new generation that is trying to kind of wipe away their parents' generations past and clear away the rubble, you know, literally. And a lot of that manifests itself in this quest for democratic design, honest design, products that are modern. They wanted to kind of, you know, redraw society in a one way they could do it is through the design of these very utilitarian objects. So the other thing that I think is notable is that the Braun brothers, you know, owned the company, gave a lot of power and a lot of influence and control to the design team. So you had a case where the designers were really determining what products should come to market and having a lot of input into what products the company should be making, not the other way around. It wasn't a marketing department deciding to, you know, build a radio and telling them, having the designers and engineers set on it. So when you have a design-led company and you have designers kind of making the things that they want to see and that were needed in kind of the landscape of, you know, German and European product design, you end up with really kind of influential products. A lot of the radios and a lot of the hi-fis that Braun is known for in that time, they weren't necessarily big sellers. These were still kind of expensive objects even for the time because they put so much kind of build quality into them and so much innovation. But, you know, now they're, of course, revered and go for, you know, thousands of dollars at auction. And, you know, it's because they were groundbreaking both in their form and also in the kind of underlying technology.
I think that's something that people born a bit later sort of maybe would miss, because when you look back at, you know, say hi-fis, whatever, or food mixes or anything from the 50s, 60s, 70s, you look back at them and you think, oh, you know, they're a slightly more primitive version of what we have today. But actually, when you go into the sort of design philosophy of someone like Dieter, you realize that, no, this is all really, really planned out, this functional minimalism and an uncluttered design and only useful features and stuff. It's not that, oh, they didn't have the vision or technology to put lots of knobs and bells and whistles on. It was because they just definitely didn't want to. And almost the bells and whistles are this sort of unfortunate kind of side effect that people have added at a later point. Was that something that you wanted to get across, this design philosophy, as well as the man himself?
Yeah, I mean, that's a key to his, you know, both his work and his personal life, is that desire to not have, I don't know, anything superfluous or anything unnecessary in his design or in his life. So yeah, you see it in the early work. I mean, a lot of times just because of the scarcity. They didn't have a lot of materials and they had to really kind of make do, you know, in the 50s in Germany with what they could get their hands on. But it's also a time of a lot of new technology. You know, plastics are really becoming, you know, more widely used. Plexiglass, you know, the SK4, which is, you know, a Braun turntable radio, was the first record turntable to have a plexiglass cover. And now we kind of just think that, you know, take that for granted. Of course, a turntable has a plexiglass cover, but when they did it, it was all new. So there was a lot of excitement, I think, for materials and for, you know, new ways of integrating technology and furniture and appliances into their lives. There's this feeling that these are products that should not stand out. They should kind of blend into your surroundings. You know, it's not about the bookshelf, it's about the books that you have on the shelf. So a lot of Rams designs, you notice that, you know, when you need them, they're there, they do their job. And then when you don't need them, they fade into the background and, you know, are neutral. They're not screaming, you know, look at me, look at me, look at me all the time, which I think a lot of products do that. I think a lot of product designers, or maybe it's like almost like an insecurity. You've got to have something on there that screams, you know, look at me, I'm important or something.
I did notice there was a quite kind of quiet yet wonderful contradiction, though. I think he does talk at some point in the film where he was talking about how everyone wants to make the fastest sports car, but he wants to make the best, most useful car, and it can be slow and sensible. And then at the end of the film, he's driving around in a Porsche, I noticed.
That's like one of the last air-cooled 911s from the 90s that he's had for a long time. And hey, if you want to talk about design and engineering, you know, in the 60s, I think, you know, Porsche is a pretty good place to look for good design. But yeah, he's always had a 911. That's kind of his thing. And I think what he was referring to in that question in the film, which was part of like a Q&A, public Q&A with design students in Munich, was that at the time that was what everybody was after. And he wasn't interested in really kind of putting his work into his work as a designer into building a faster car. But an interesting thing and what drew me to making the film about Dieter was that he's 87 years old. You know, he's this old German guy, you know, trimming bonsai trees in his backyard. But he's still really thinking on a kind of a global level and thinking about urbanization and thinking about sustainability. And he's got views on everything. And it's remarkable because he doesn't have the internet, he doesn't have a computer, but he's remarkably well-informed nonetheless. To me, it wasn't just about his designs and all this amazing stuff they did at Braun. It was about his mind and what he's thinking about now, looking back on his career and seeing how the world has changed in the past 60 years and how technology has really impacted the way we behave now as a species. So those are the bigger things that I was interested in.
That is a kind of talking point today. I mean, obviously we have the climate issue and the waste issue that designers are constantly now trying to think in clever ways about. And that was something that he was sort of, was he explicitly saying that he was trying to combat that thinking in sort of the 70s, or was it part of his conversation, but not so clearly pointed out like today?
Part of his conversation, you know, from the 70s on, you know, he's been talking about sustainability and about the design industry kind of coming to terms with that for, you know, over 40 years. So the film opens with him reading from this speech that he gave in New York in 1976 that was like, you know, the time for thoughtless design, for thoughtless consumption is over. And that, you know, future generations will shudder at the amount of junk that, you know, we've put into the world. So it's something he's been talking about for a while. I think within the design community, you know, I think it's hard for, you know, one designer to kind of get that message out to the entire world and to kind of, you know, beyond the design trade. But it's been something he's been talking about for a long time. And I think that maybe one of the reasons that he agreed to do the film, it took me a while to convince him to do it because he did not want to have a documentary made about him. But I think one of the reasons that he finally did agree is, you know, that it would be one more way for him to get that message out to the next generation, you know, both of designers and of consumers.
I wanted to talk about how you yourself came into filmmaking, because you've been making these certainly design-minded films for over a decade now. You know, you started with Helvetica, which was about typography and fonts, and then before that you were producing films, you know, anything from design to music. I mean, you were part of the Wilco documentary, I'm Trying to Break Your Heart, which that almost helped, I think, make that band as well known as some of their albums and stuff. How did you specifically get into filmmaking then?
I had no intention of being a filmmaker. I didn't go to film school, but I ended up, you know, after I was kicked out of college a couple times, working with a lot of bands that were friends of mine and getting involved in the independent music industry in the 80s and 90s. And there was just always this kind of DIY, you know, do-it-yourself ethic to everything we did. You know, no one was going to book my friend's band. So, okay, well, let's just rent a hotel ballroom and get a bunch of friends together and put on a show.
We should mention to people, these aren't just any bands or any record label. This was SST in California in the 80s, the home of bands like Black Flag and Sonic Youth and people like that, which is a not unsubstantial historic footnote, I think, in a career.
It was an incredible time, and they're just, you know, amazing bands. But that's kind of where I learned, you know, grassroots distribution and really this idea that don't wait for anyone else's permission or blessing or, you know, kind of this gatekeeper system that seems to be set up in a lot of the kind of music and film and entertainment industries. Just do it yourself. Just make it happen. So I didn't know anything about films, but I got really into DVDs when DVDs first kind of appeared, like 1999, I think I got my first DVD player. And I just kind of became obsessed with it. And I also realized that there was no good independent films out there on DVD at the time. It was all major studio stuff. So I just kept thinking that somebody needed to start an independent record label, but for film. So Plexifilm, which was my label that we started in 2001, we started releasing, you know, old 60s films that we loved or, you know, new independent documentaries or experimental films. And through that, the Wilco project came. It was kind of, you know, midway through production, and the filmmaker kind of just needed help finishing it and releasing it. So we got involved, and through a few projects like that, helping other filmmakers produce their work, I saw the whole kind of production process of documentary. And I'd always just been a design nerd, you know, I'd just been into fonts, and, you know, I had one of the early Macintoshes, and I was never a professional designer, but I liked type. I got it, you know, interested in typography and graphic design. And, you know, ultimately, I just wanted to watch a movie about these incredible designers and just the influence that type plays in our lives every day. And there was nothing out there. This is in 2005. And I was like, I can't believe there isn't a great documentary about graphic design and fonts. So at that point, I just decided to learn how to direct films, and just, you know, I'd never picked up a camera before. And I just decided to make Helvetica. And then that was it.
When you make a film like something, or any topic related to design, I guess, I mean, design is such a constantly evolving thing. And specifically when you made that film Helvetica, which is obviously about this font, which is meant to be this almost completely sort of purist, unaffected font, which anyone can use to communicate any message. And the message should be in the word, not in the sort of flowery detail of the font. So it's this sort of, you know, really timeless thing. Are you sort of aware with how your own work might date? You know, are you concerned that maybe that documentary will one day look 10 or 20 years old in the things that it's saying about this timeless topic, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think about that so much when I'm making the film. I am trying to focus on the ideas and sort of the principles behind these topics, and not necessarily the surface gloss. So I can even like look at a film like Objectified, which is 10 years old now, and, you know, the technology looks so dated to me. There's like, you know, CRT, you know, computers and TVs and stuff in it. But the ideas behind it all, in terms of the design principles and things like sustainability and everything, have not changed at all. So, yeah, I try to focus on the ideas and just try to make a film that I would want to watch. I am the audience for all these movies. And luckily, there are other people out there who want to watch them too, and make it possible for me to keep making them. But every single film, it's just something that I really want to watch and that I just can't believe doesn't exist already.
One of the projects is the Animal Collective, the visual album that you helped produce with that. I mean, what was the process of making something like that? Because that's really not conventional. It's like, is it an album? Is it music? Like, I guess what I'm saying is, what's the initial conversation when the band come to someone like you to try and help make something like that?
Yeah, that was Danny Perez, who's the director of that film. I can't even, I think it came to us through friends, because we have a lot of musicians that either were working for us or that we were working with. And it would just sounded like the most, you know, insane idea for a film. And, you know, again, it was very DIY. So it wasn't like a huge budget, but it was like an amazing concept. And, you know, I produced it, so I wasn't really as involved. I the role sometimes of a producer is just to kind of enable the creativity and then just like step back and watch it happen. So Danny and the band just, you know, disappear into the forest for weeks and come back with this totally psychedelic, you know, mind fuck of a film. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes it's not about the conference table pitch. It's just, it's about letting really creative people express their creativity and trying to enable it and not trying to kind of control it or to guide it. And that's a really great example of that. But yeah, it premiered at Sundance. We did a big tour of it back in 2010, I think. And it was just really super fun. And also, like, I don't see that many bands now putting that kind of energy and songwriting work and recording and production work into something like that. It was like a magical mystery tour or something like that, you know, which it was just really cool to be a part of.
And you've currently got some photography from sort of taken around the Theatre Rums documentary, which is on show in London at the Vitzo shop and space here in Marylebone. Tell us a little bit about his relationship with Vitzo, because that's sort of this tandem kind of relationship that he had, as well as the progressive technology that he was making with Braun.
Yeah, it's right around the time that he started designing with Braun. He also started working with Vitzo, which was a furniture company that was, I think, again, it's kind of sharing a kind of common philosophy in terms of the things they were producing. So Rem started designing bookshelves and chairs and other furniture for Vitzo. It didn't really compete with the kind of home electronics and consumer goods of Braun, so they were okay with him sort of moonlighting on the side with Vitzo. You know, he's been working with that company since, you know, the late 50s. And some of the things that he designed at that point, like the 606 shelving system, are still in production and have been continuously in production. And it's mind-blowing to think of Rams as a 20-something designing that system, and it's still basically unchanged today. They've made a lot of structural improvements to it, with the newer technology, but it's really like you hit a home run, you know, in your first, you know, at bat, basically, and it's still just an incredible design.
And finally, because it's just a pleasure to be able to crowbar in a question about California punk during a chat about German industrial design. Who was the best singer in Black Flag?
I gotta go with Henry Rollins, just because when I got into the band, Rollins was already the lead singer. It was post Keith Morris, so I know that's controversial, but I think I'll stick with Hank.
Do you think that Rollins was doing more with less, like Theatre Rams?
I don't know about that, but I do think that punk rock is kind of like a modernist movement, not on the visual aesthetic side, but on the kind of, again, this idea of creating the world that you want to live in.
Gary Hustwit there, speaking to Tong Ho. His film Runs is available now. And listeners in London should also head to Vitzo's London Design Space here in Marylebone, where a series of Gary's photographs taken during the making of that film are now on show until the 20th of July.
It's time for a tune, Faye, and, well, you heard the man. This is Black Flag, with Henry Rollins on vocals, of course, with Thirsty and Miserable. Thirsty and Miserable there by California's own Black Flag. What do you think of that, Faye?
Well, it's interesting. It's a departure from my usual electropop, but I like it.
Excellent.
It's a good choice.
I think so. I'm all in favour. We'll be hearing from philosopher Maria Balasca just after this.
Download the free Monocle 24 app today to tune in wherever in the world you happen to be. Whether you're catching up on the news on your daily commute, enjoying a little cultural nourishment during your morning run, or seeking some recipe inspiration around the kitchen table, the Monocle 24 app allows you to tune in live or download your favourite shows to enjoy later. Get started by downloading the Monocle 24 app today. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
tired of seeing the same few tedious tourist haunts?
Well, the Monocle Travel Guide series has stopped off in 30-plus cities and counting in order to dispense advice on travelling like a local. From the finest spot in which to sip a cocktail with a contact, work up a sweat, or take a dip, our comprehensive travel guide series are packed with tips, essays, and tidbits for getting the very best from your destination. Monocle's Travel Guide series is published by Gestalten, the Monocle Travel Guide series. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Maria Balaska is lecturer in philosophy at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK, and her most recent book looks at the concept of astonishment. What causes that feeling of inexplicable wonder we all get from time to time? How do we measure it? And how, Faye, do we even begin to describe it?
Maria has had a go doing that in her book, Wittgenstein and Lacan at the Limit. The title refers to Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who largely explored issues of logic, and French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, known for challenging our conventional ideas on structural thinking.
She joined Monocle's rather wide-eyed Robert Bound to explain more.
I've always been interested in cases that are hard to express in language, that kind of touch on the inexpressible. And the case of astonishment is one of these cases. It is moments in life when we are struck by something that seems to be extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Think of the case where suddenly you realize that you are alive, right? And you are astonished at that. Now, that's not something new. You already knew that you were alive, but suddenly it takes on this kind of absolute significance. There are many examples. We can also think of the negative case where you realize that you're going to die. That can also be astonishing.
We'll say that at the end of the show.
let's have more positive, optimistic things for the end. But also cases of beauty where you're moved by something beautiful, say a flower, and you feel astonished when looking at it, or...
And this is that people will hopefully be familiar with the sensation of falling in love. This is something that is there something about astonishment to that? Or is that, as a philosopher such as yourself, a whole different ball game, a whole different 100 books to be written about that? Or is that part of astonishment, or is astonishment part of that?
I think you're very right to bring this up, because one of the experiences I had in mind is the experience of feeling absolutely safe and in harmony, and that the world is just lovely. And that is something that happens when we are in love. Now, the tricky thing with all the experiences we mentioned is that when someone asks us, so why is that astonishing? What is it? It's quite hard to put it into words. And that's where the interesting thing begins for me.
And it's an interesting thing. And your premise is that notions of astonishment, the quality of the feeling of astonishment is kind of undeliverable, is undefinable in words. Mm. So where do you take us on this journey?
So I think we think that it is undefinable. I think that we have a good reason to think so, but I don't think that that's the end of the matter. So in the book, I'm trying to argue that even though it seems hard, language can actually do it. It can do the job. It can express such moments, but not if what we are asking is, what is it about it that makes it astonishing? So we need more creative forms of expression, more imaginative forms of expression to meet the requirements of that experience.
And so people, sports commentators on the television, Wimbledon is on right now, people will be familiar with the word astonishing. Things are described, drop shots, serves, amazing goals in football, etc., are described as astonishing. It is kind of one of the go-tos of the lazy sports reporter, for example. Do you think they're using that word wrongly, or do you feel that that they are simply the definition of astonishment maybe is just an exclamation rather than a word?
Thanks so much for this question. So because even though such experiences like the one you just mentioned, where we see something that is rare, that is pretty amazing, are experiences that can be described as surprising, mm-hmm. that cause wonder, or I don't really want to put them under astonishment, because I want to reserve that term for cases where something that is quite ordinary seems to get this extraordinary significance. So when it comes to experiences that concern something rare or something weird or a novelty, then there is no difficulty to express that in language, right? Because you can ask, what was so amazing about that goal? And I can say that it's a rare goal, or we didn't
rare skill,
expect it.
Or yeah. Isn't it amazing they scored it in the last minute
exactly.
of the game or something? Yeah.
Yeah. And that satisfies your question, my answer. While in the case I'm interested in, there's something harder when it comes to the question, what is it about the fact that you're alive that makes it suddenly so significant, even though you knew about that 5 minutes ago?
And how do you define, you define astonishment as, in a philosophical way, as a kind of, you two have two poles, perhaps. Maybe I'm wrong in saying this, but you as you say, let me start the question again. You've called your book Lacan and Wittgenstein at the Limits, and you say in the preface that you can bringing two people together does not necessarily mean that you're comparing them.
Mm-hmm.
And I had trouble with that. I read that sentence a few times and I scratched my head and I thought, I don't know whether I agree with you, but I'm clearly wrong. I just need to be told why that is not the case. I don't think I can put two things of any sort next to each other, especially similar things, and not want, it's the human device to want to compare.
Yeah.
No?
I suppose I said that because they are very different. Mm-hmm. So when you bring together two things, two authors that are so different, the terms under which you compare them might be tricky. So I decided to put them together, not to compare them, but to bring their stories on astonishment. And then the reader can draw their own conclusions, but you know, you can put two things together without saying, oh, here's one trait that is like that trait in the other thing. Just leave them there. And then by leaving them there, that kind of does the job.
Does the trick.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. Is it something to do with, I don't know, so you don't think it's a human instinct to put two things next to each other and want to compare them? I mean, you can compare and contrast. We tend to find, maybe this is just something to do with the media climate we live in at the moment, and the fact that we're sitting in a radio studio where we often ask people to define things, to find fault with things sometimes, rather than finding similarities between things. Is that also a philosophical problem? Is that something that you address in the book, Maria?
In a way, your question takes us back to the astonishment and the difficulty of expression there. Because what causes the difficulty is that there is someone, perhaps someone in yourself, that says, okay, but I want to know, what is it about it that makes it astonishing? So you want to hear about these facts. Likewise, in the case of comparing two things, you might have this temptation to say, okay, I want to know exactly what traits they share. But I think in some spheres of life, that's not very helpful. And having, again, a more imaginative approach where you let your mind do the work without asking these questions can be more helpful.
Is there a sense that astonishment, being able to give yourself up to astonishment, is a sort of healthy thing to be able to do? Is that kind of part of your
yeah.
treatise as well? That
yeah.
we, by trying to learn too much, by trying to define, by trying to use language, by trying to define the emotions and the reasons for those emotions, we don't let astonishment knock us over in the road in a good way.
Yes, I agree. Yes, that is the thesis. So there is this phrase in Plato that says that philosophy begins in wonder and nowhere else. Now, philosophy is thinking, basically. And why does it begin in wonder? Because that's the case where a question comes up, right? Astonishment or wonder are cases where something inexplicable is there and we don't really know how to deal with it. Now, if everything was explicable, then thinking wouldn't really have much.
You'd be out of a job, right?
That too.
What can we do to can we put ourselves into positions? If we say that astonishment is a positive state of mind to be in, or a positive thing to be able to absorb and realise one is at that point, can we do more to open ourselves up to astonishment, to feel the cool balm of astonishment wash over us?
I love that phrase, open ourselves up, because this is precisely what it is about. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing about astonishment is that you cannot wish it to come, and you cannot wish it away, just like falling in love, that you mentioned earlier. So what you can do is create more space for it. And I think creating more space means perhaps creating more time in our lives where we're not bombarded with, I don't know, images and things and particular thoughts. And so just having more space and time.
I feel like astonishment. I feel maybe it's because I'm speaking to a philosopher and a Greek philosopher. Mm. I feel that astonishment sort of at its purest level perhaps existed thousands of years ago on a stony outcrop somewhere in the Cyclades, maybe.
They did have time. I mean, that came with a cost, right? There were some others who didn't really have time.
Indeed.
Indeed, it's a social, political, historical issue too, to be able to create a society that allows for more of that. So it's not, I don't think it's only the individual that has to try and create more space in their own individual lives, but you need a society that allows for more time for reflection, for wonder, for curiosity.
And in the writing and research of your book, did you find research that you found particularly astonishing? Did you experience any astonishment while you were writing it? Because I know the writing of an academic book, even on an attractively unusual subject such as this, actually is a work of it's a job of work rather than necessarily always a job of wonder. So were you astonished while writing the book?
Well, I was definitely astonished at how much one can complete with working, because it took a few years to write. But I was also astonished at language itself, like at the creative potential it has, because when I started, I didn't really have that view or thought. So as I was working more and more on the issue, I realized that language is quite creative, quite strong when it comes to the creative power it has. So
there's no difficulty. So although we struggle to define astonishment, although maybe language obfuscates astonishment, you managed to set it down with the imperfect tools of language in the best way possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a relief to us all, and for anyone that wants to dip into Lacan and Wittgenstein at the limit. And before we go, Maria, when was the last time you were astonished?
A few days ago.
Yeah, are you going to tell us how? Is it a private matter?
No. I actually do get astonished quite frequently. I don't know if it is a philosopher's thing, but especially with nature, I have these experiences quite often where I'm thinking, oh God, that is beautiful, you know, and I'm moved by it. But then it's not that the thing I'm looking at is exceptionally beautiful. It's just a flower or a tree or... so I have these little silly moments.
And then does the kind of professional brain kick in? Are you always trying to explain things away, or are you trying to deepen your sense?
Perhaps that's why I wrote this book.
Yeah.
Perhaps a few years ago my professional mind would kick in more easily, and now it doesn't, at least not in the way it used to.
Maria, thank you very much
for
joining us. Dr. Maria Belasca from the University of Hertfordshire, and her book is Lacan and Wittgenstein at the Limit. Thank you.
Tune in now to Métier Class by Chanel on Monocle 24. Join us over 5 fascinating episodes as we explore the craftsmanship, precision, artistry, and design philosophy of the House of Chanel with its family of collaborators. The season began in homage to the late, great Karl Lagerfeld, who for decades stood for the best of a brand with a truly unique heritage.
We heard too from Chanel Fashion President Bruno Pavlovsky, and you can hear more from some of those who know this storied brand better than anyone else, as Pharrell Williams and Lady Amanda Harlech join Monocle's editor Tyler Brulé to tell him more about the inner workings of the fashion house. Tune in at monocle.com via our app and other channels, or on Chanel's 355 podcast at iTunes. Métier Classe by Chanel on Monocle 24. Listen now.
As part of British indie rock outfit The Maccabees, guitarist Felix White learned a thing or two about creating a sense of drama through music. Since the band disbanded, however, he's found something of a new direction, entering a second career as a cricket journalist and broadcaster, while keeping his hand in the indie world with Yalla Records, a label he co-founded.
His latest project sees him consolidate his skills. He's created the soundtrack to new documentary The Edge, which traces the England cricketing as they rose from abjection in 2009 to the pinnacle of cricketing success.
Earlier, Monocle's culture editor and resident Maccabees fan Chiara Rimella and I caught up with Felix to discuss the film. Chiara began by asking what it is about cricket that makes it such a popular game in the first place.
There's a beautiful thing about cricket, I think, without going into too much detail, right, is that when you're young and little, it appeals to people because it's throwing, hitting, all the sort of primal instincts and things that are fun. But because cricket goes on for so long and it suits so many different types of people, so you don't have to necessarily be athletic to be a very good batsman. So it suits every different sort of body type and personality, so everyone can exist within it. It develops a lot of peripherals for life. You know, there's a lot of metaphors for life happening in cricket pitches, and that's what separates it from a lot of other sports. All the best sports literature is about cricket or baseball, and I think it's because they have all that poetic literary references that will exist within that game. It's so much can happen within it.
So I don't know an awful lot of about cricket, but I do know quite a lot about documentaries, films and music.
Sure.
And if there's one thing that documentary producers will always say, is that for a documentary to work, be it a biopic or whatever, it needs to be a universal story.
Right.
And I mean, this documentary, which we're talking about, The Edge, is basically your ultimate kind of underdog story.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the point I think that you've landed on, is exactly what this film does do. It's not really about cricket. It's about what happens when a group of people, mostly alpha, are trying to achieve something together, and what the collateral damage of that is. The last half an hour of this film is so beautiful because it's a lot of men talking about the residue and the damage when you've made this existence your only thing and your whole identity is wrapped up on being good at cricket, and when your body fails you, the consequences of that. And so it's actually really moving, especially towards the end. I think a lot of people that have tried to achieve anything in a group, be it bands, making films, artists, are going to see exact parallels in this film. And that's the point of the film, I think.
This is what's good about the documentary as well. Like all good sports documentaries, you don't need to be a fan of the sport already to
exactly
watch it. So we can kind of let you off explaining cricket for now, because people
can
watch it.
I can tell you the rules, but it might be really boring.
No, we'll let people tune into your radio show for that. The point being, though, that it tells this tale, and it tells it very effectively, and it makes cricket really compelling. How do you go about, though, soundtracking a documentary like this? When you're looking at it, you have these highs and lows. It has this ending that's full of pathos. Like, are you looking for beats in the cut? Where's your starting point?
Well, that's it. I mean, because I'd spoken about it with Barney Douglas, the director, for a while, and I'd premeditated quite a lot of music. And having never... The Maccabees, my band, we'd done a couple of sort of cinematic things, but obviously my background had been writing songs, so it was always 3 minutes of worth songs, but I don't necessarily have any sort of visual aid. That's what I'd done. So this was a totally new discipline, actually. And when I got the film, I had a lot of music that I thought was going to work. And to be honest, there's a lot of old demos, like, oh, yeah, that kind of thing. But as soon as I saw it, I just sort of started instinctively writing to it. So all the music that's in the film happened almost immediately on the spot in reference to what I saw. And so that was the really enjoyable approach for me. But it just happened on the back of it. And the one thing that I was aware of what I was trying to do is, even in the moments when they're successful and they're winning, there's like a melancholy to that, because that's the end of a process. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And there's always a sadness or some sort of subtext to that. Plus, I was really emotionally invested in all these cricketers, because I've been watching them pretty much non-stop play for 15 years. So the fact that they'd been so open and vulnerable in speaking about how it actually felt, I felt like it was my service to them, really, to sort of serve a backdrop of it, yeah.
I did wonder if it was in a way kind of cathartic if you had these big sort of tunes like pounding in your head when you're watching them play at the Oval or something, if you're like that, if you're soundtracking it.
Yeah, I don't think you normally do, but there is a rhythm. There is like a rhythm to cricket, which is not frenetic, but it has like a momentum to it. I was trying to show people that might not be interested in it what I found so compelling about cricket, do you know what I mean? Subliminally. So it was, yeah, I mean, I could have had a more perfect film to be doing, to be honest.
The toughest thing about playing Test cricket is the psychological trauma.
You've only got to take your eye off the ball for a split second, and the first chip happens.
We weren't aware of what your teammates are going through.
I did isolate myself.
Crying in a dressing room. Everything just seemed to come tumbling down.
It became a life or death situation.
You mentioned something in your earlier response, which is that you were already writing cinematic music. And I wonder, I know the Maccabees and I can see that, but I wonder what makes the perfect cinematic music? What does cinematic music sound like? Is it always the rousing, the orchestral, the kind of going upwards, or what is the perfect cinematic music?
I mean, I'm probably too early in my infancy to tell you exactly that in terms of paying it off, but from doing this and then suddenly getting locked into music and film, the thing that I really like was that subtly suggesting feeling without telling anyone how to feel. I really like that a lot. So that kind of idea that you can't use as many things, you can't load it full of music, but you've just got to suggest something and let the viewer do the rest. That's the stuff that moves me. So as I kind of even going back and watching things like Taxi Driver and Scarface and realising like these big moments that you imagine to be really orchestral, it's actually just one synth just playing one note, like, you know what I mean? And they must, and there's so little actually in that, but it does so much. That's what I liked, yeah.
I should have known that you'd have some kind of eclectic reference points for this film,
yeah.
Scarface and Taxi Driver, because no. you once recommended, what did you recommend me? Scott Walker, Farmer in the City, I think.
Oh yeah, and did you get into that?
Oh man, I bought every album since.
Isn't that amazing?
I absolutely love it. Yeah, I was so upset when he died.
I'm glad you brought it up because I like some of the sounds in it. Is that dissonant strings thing, which is like slightly unnerving, and I've always thinking about that cinematically, like in The Shining or whatever, when the TV's on but it's unplugged and you never notice that it was unplugged, but there's something about the image that makes it feel slightly like uncomfortable and preeminates what's going to happen. So I like that kind of thing, like before the cricket is opened up to you, you've got that dissonance, you're like, something's happening here.
Yeah. And with the cricket, to go back into the film, there must be a lot that you can relate to. You know, these guys are going out to play these high pressure matches. Obviously, it's competitive, and when you're performing, that's hopefully not competitive.
Yeah.
Or maybe the band is quite dysfunctional
if it is.
Yeah. These guys are under this kind of gladiatorial pressure, but still they're performing in front of these huge crowds.
Sure.
They're kind of pulling together into a cohesive unit. And is that something that your background in the Maccabees kind of, do you think that empathy that you have for that, is that something that you could bring to the,
yeah,
to the soundtrack,
think
to
you
writing
can,
it?
I think anyone can relate to when you make something and you do it to that standard and that many people. In order to do it, you have to make that your whole life. And the reality of that is that there are a lot of sacrifices that come with that. And actually, quite a lot of the things that enable you to do that leave you totally unprepared for your life beyond that. Do you know what I mean? So like I'm reading this book called The Cost of These Dreams, a writer called Wright Thompson, and his stuff about Michael Jordan and things like that, and about how people really have to deal with what happens after they achieve greatness. You know, and I'm not saying the Maccabees did that, but definitely these players did. And there's something very similar in the activity of putting it together, for sure.
It's quite curious though, because naturally you are in that phase after the Maccabees, and you've had a pretty kind of dramatic career change. How did it happen from rock band to cricket commentator?
I don't know is a short answer, really. To be honest, when a band ended, that had been 15 years of my life, and that was quite a big thing to deal with, because I'd sort of naively imagined that that was going to be my whole life. So when I was sort of resurfacing after a couple of months and thinking that I really don't know what I'm going to do, I just decided that I was going to say yes to everything. And it kind of led me down some like quite strange routes.
Another puff?
Yeah. Not yes to everything. But I wasn't offered it, yeah. But so I ended up just working loads of different things, and some things that I didn't enjoy, some things that I did. But I guess the culmination up to this point is doing like music for film and that kind of thing, yeah.
So did somebody come to you with the cricket commenting?
Well, okay,
or the
so I'll tell you how the cricket thing happened. So I've always loved cricket. And when the band split up, the first person I thought of was I'd met a cricketer 2 years previous who was in the dressing room of the Maccabee dressing room, and he was just loading the fridge in and out of water. And he used to be a cricketer, and his back had gone, and he just had to start his whole life because they don't get paid a lot of money, and he's starting as a really low-level rep. So when the band split up, I thought of him, and I pitched this magazine that I could do a piece about what happens to all cricketers when they retire. So I ended up talking to really big ones like Brett Lee and Andrew Flint and stuff, but also county cricketers who had done stuff like become shoe salesmen or started coffee shops and all that kind of thing whilst going through my own sense of catharsis. So I did this big piece, and then that ended up tail enders. Greg James and Jimmy Anderson end up saying, why don't we do this show, which has become a thing, and that's eventually got off to this film. So one thing strangely leads to the other.
But you're keeping your hand in musically with the soundtrack, but also with Yalla.
That was another thing that we got going when the Maccabees broke up, and that's been 3 years now, and we put out 10 records on Yalla, and we do these regular nights in London, but now we did a festival stage at All Points East, and it's going around the country, and so that's really becoming a thing of its own life as well. Now Yalla,
it's so momentum.
You've been down Yalla, haven't you?
I've been down Yalla, yeah. I had a good time. Yeah. How do you kind of consolidate these different things? It's like a lot of plates that you're spinning.
Yeah, it's confusing sometimes.
Yeah,
and I don't imagine that I can do it forever. At the moment, one kind of informs the other. The thing you do struggle with, like a cricketer probably does, is that you know when people used to ask you, like, what do you do? And they go, oh, I'm in a band. They go, oh, cool. I know who this guy is. He's in a band. And you think you're quite safe in your space. And now when people ask you, like, oh, I'm kind of like, do cricket writing, but also like, oh, we used to be in this band and I've kind of got a record label. And so it makes you feel like you're saying, I'm a sort of model / actor. but you know what I mean? Yeah. So you have to change how you feel about yourself, but that's all internal work.
And do you have a favourite child?
Yeah, making music is the thing that I really love doing. So the one thing I have realised in the last few years is that in order to be happy, actually, I have to be able to make music in some form. So this was a good excuse to kind of do it, have a project to get into. Yeah.
Mm. A feature film next time, potentially.
Potentially, mate, anything, yeah.
All right.
I'm still saying yes to stuff, so.
Felix, thanks so much for joining us. And The Edge, which is out on limited theatrical UK release from the 19th of July, and it will be available on all platforms from the 22nd. You're with The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, that's all for edition 523 of The Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager is Max Bauer. And The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, of course. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Augusto Macellari.
Goodbye.
Bye.